The Bang on a Can Summer Music Festival is underway at Mass Mocha in North Adams for the 13th year. This year, the festival culminates with an 8-day new music extravaganza called Bang on a Can Plays Art from July 26th through the 2nd of August. 14 concerts over this 8-day period will draw inspiration from the visual art on exhibit in the galleries at Mass Mocha. For example, on July 29th, the festival fellows will perform a new work called Paper Chorus, wearing the paper sculptures of artist Anne Hamilton. On the 31st, Bang on a Can Plays Saul LeWitt will feature music of Reich?
Mm-hmm.
Steve Reich, who was a friend and admirer of Saul LeWitt. The festival also features a Bang on a Can all-star performance of David Wang's Death Speaks on July 26th, among numerous other events commissioned by Carnegie Hall and Stanford Lively Arts. Death Speaks draws its initial inspiration from the work of Schubert. David Lang joins us now. David, thank you very, very much. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So tell us a little bit about this, how this came to be for you.
Which aspect? The festival?
Let's go with the work.
Oh, the work. Okay. So I wrote a piece a few years ago called The Little Match Girl Passion, which luckily enough won the Pulitzer Prize, which was very nice.
Yes.
And in that...
Nothing wrong with that.
No, that was really great. That was a very nice day. and what happened in that piece is it tells the story of the Hans Christian Andersen story, The Little Match Girl, and it intercuts it with scenes of the crowd reactions from the Bach St. Matthew Passion. And so that piece ends in this place where the little girl has died, and she goes up into heaven, and she is in a better place, but we left behind feel really miserable and really terrible. It's a really kind of gut-wrenching situation for us. And so Carnegie Hall, which commissioned The Little Match Girl Passion, commissioned me to write a piece which would go on a concert with The Little Match Girl. And I thought, well, where is that girl? You know, and what is this feeling? You know, we all feel so terrible because we are still here. She's been transformed, and it's clear from the story that she's gone to a better place. What is that better place? What was Hans Christian Andersen's idea of death, where this little girl went? And so I thought, sort of vaguely coincident with Hans Christian Andersen a little earlier, we have a lot of ideas about what people thought of who death is and, you know, what the character of death might be from the songs of Franz Schubert, because Schubert wrote many, many songs in which death is a named character. So I just had this little light bulb moment where I thought, I wonder what would happen if I go through all the different texts that Schubert set in his entire life and just see if I can find incidents where death is a character. Like, he has a very famous song called Death and the Maiden, and in that, the song is actually split into two parts, where the first part is named as the girl saying, I don't want to die, I'm scared. And then death comes in with this incredibly beautiful and reassuring talk about how calm it is where he is and how relaxed the girl will be if she only goes along with him. So I looked at all the Schubert songs, and of course there's the Erl King, where, you know, death follows the boy on horseback, and there's the end of the Schönemüllerin, where the river calls to the miller to commit suicide because life is so much more peaceful there. And I started looking at these songs, and I realized, you know, actually there is this idea that death is a calming presence to these people, that death actually says things which are inviting and creepy, but also somehow reassuring. And I put them all together, just these little incidents of where death is a character in the Schubert librettos, and I set them to my own music. And that's it.
The setting to the own music is, it is a rock pace, right?
Well,
is that fair to say?
I used musicians who have become successful in rock and roll and in mostly indie pop.
Right.
But I actually had I think way too much for these pieces, really. You know, so I had this kind of philosophical idea that when Schubert wrote these songs, you know, they're very intimate and expressive and emotional, and he wrote them for audiences of 10 or 20 people.
Right.
And yet when we go see Schubert Lieder now sung by Ian Bostrich or someone, it's in Carnegie Hall in front of 3,000 people. So I thought, who actually has that same sound world now where we go to a small club and we hear an intimate personal expression from a singer That doesn't maybe happen so much in classical music anymore, but it still happens in indie pop, where you can go to a little club in the Village or go to Lena's Cafe Lena and see, you know, something really tiny and intimate and heartfelt. So I thought maybe I could find people from the who had become successful in the rock world, but who started as classical musicians, and invite them back. And so this my song cycle was written for Shara Warden, who is somebody who started as an opera singer and then started a band, My Brightest Diamond, and became much more successful. The guitarist in the band was Bryce Dessner, who's a founder of The National, plays in giant arenas. The violinist in the band is Owen Pallett, who's an Arcade Fire, but who also, you know, started as a classical musician. And then the pianist was the composer Nico Muhly, who is, of course, you know, welcome in classical music and in pop music at the same time. So,
correct me, because I was curious about something you just said, because I don't know if it was slightly apologetic in saying I think too much about these. Did you say that?
Well, I spend a lot of time thinking, if you have an idea, how far can you push it? You know, so sometimes I push these ideas too far, you know. So for me to just take Schubert's text wasn't enough. You know, it's like I actually want to think about the world that Schubert came from and the experience and what it was like to be in the audience listening to these kind of emotional conversations with Schubert and his singer in a salon in front of 10 people. You know, what did that feel like? You know, I want to be there.
Because I talk with a lot of writers and we talk about the process of writing a book, but then that process of thinking about a book. So for you as a composer, there is the physical writing of the music, but then there's the thinking of the project.
Yeah, the thinking about the project is much more fun than the writing of the music, I have to say.
Right.
You know, you can write a piece of music and it can be the most beautiful thing in the world, but it could be something that just, you know, hits you for 1 second and you just write it down and it's really beautiful. And there's a lot of music that's written that way that's really great, but that's not really the way I work. I really like to work to think about what the implications are of something and to really push them as far as I can go. And that's really the fun part for me.
Is there anything that it doesn't seem this way? But it doesn't seem like there's really any boundary for you in the sense of that you always are starting with a clean canvas and there's nothing saying, oh, okay, I can't do this. Oh, no penny whistles. You know, anything can go.
Well, I just wrote a piece for 1,000 people yelling in the street that premiered in London and Berlin and Birmingham, England. And before that, I wrote an opera that premiered at Lincoln Center last year called The Whisper Opera, which is so quiet that no one can hear it. You know, I feel like what's really interesting to me is that I love classical music so much, and I have a doctorate in it. I teach classical music at Yale, and, you know, I'm completely immersed in classical music. But I am always aware of the fact that that music is capable of doing so many other things that we don't ask it to do. Maybe some of these things are things we shouldn't ask it to do, but I'm very lucky that at this point in my career I get to sort of, wake up in the morning and think that I have no boundaries for this, which is really great. Thanks for noticing that, by the way.
Well, sure. I think it's just whispering. Okay.
Yeah.
So you come up with that and you say, all right, I want to do this. And then is there ever doubt of, assuming you feel confident enough that you can make it work, that other people will understand what you're doing, or don't you care about that?
Well, I think if I understand it and if it's meaningful to me and if I present it with a big enough doorway so that people can get into it, that other people will figure it out as well. You know, I'm not interested in doing things which are just to occupy my own imagination. You know, I always tell my students that you think the piece of music is the thing that you write in your studio, but actually the piece of music is the communication that you make between you and your performer or you and your listener, and that whole action, the making of it, the presenting of it, and the receiving of it, that's all the musical act. So just sitting in your studio and thinking, I have a great idea and I'm a genius, you know, that's worthless, you know. But it's the communication. It's that you know, kind of circuit that you close by saying, you know, here's my thing that I've started and now you have received it. that whole thing is the musical act, and I'm interested in how that works.
How much control do you want to have over it when it's performed? In the sense of past works, do you send them out into the world, or do you still want some hand and control when they are performed?
That's a really great question, because some composers are very picky,
right,
about how things work, and there's like only one way to do it. And some composers are very free and very open, and they send their music out. And of course, you know, dead composers are the freest of them all. You know, they can't complain.
Right.
So I try to act like a dead composer as much as possible. You know, I like the idea that you make something which is in some respects a problem to be solved by a player, and you send it out in the world, and then you end up being very curious and sometimes very surprised and sometimes even, you know, kind of pleasantly surprised, mm-hmm, by how the problem is solved by other people.
So when we talk about this performance and this participation in Bang on a Can in the Summer Festival, I mean, obviously you're there and you're very much a part of it.
Right.
So that's a different experience.
Right. No, when I'm there, I'm very opinionated and very, you know, I have ideas about how to make these things work. But I try to build in opportunities for other people to do things. And it's an interesting mix of how to live a life.
I want to talk to you more about your creative process. I want to talk more about Bang on a Can. And we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. David Wang joins us. His Death Speaks will be performed at Mass MoCA this Saturday at 8 o'clock as part of the 13th annual Bang on a Can Summer Music Festival. We'll be back after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Marshall & Sterling Insurance for business, home, auto, bonds, group benefits, and financial planning. For 150 years... our people are your best insurance. Offices in Leeds and Saratoga Springs. MarshallSterling.com/Leeds. SPAC, presenting the Bolshoi Ballet, performing Don Quixote at SPAC from July 29th to August 1st. SPAC.org. Austerlitz Historical Society, presenting the 15th annual Blueberry Festival in Old Austerlitz, New York. Sunday, July 27th, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. OldAusterlitz.org. And Field Goods, delivering fresh produce from local farms for pickups at workplaces or community sites in the Capital District and in the Mid and Lower Hudson Valley. Field-goods.com.
Welcome back to the roundtable. David Wang is our guest this morning. He is going to, his Death Speaks is going to be performed as part of Bang on a Can All-Star and their summer festival, which takes place on Saturday night at 8 o'clock. And it's part of this wonderful event, which is 8 days of really cool stuff, a new music extravaganza at Mass MoCA in North Adams. So, David Wang, one of the things that I was struck by in reading about you and reading pieces about your work is so often the intelligence that comes in the background. How do you define musical intelligence in the sense of for an audience? There's the background, obviously, and you're describing the process of what. Of where you come from and how it is created has a great intelligence. But for those of us sitting in the seat and listening, how is that conveyed, do you think?
That's a fantastic question, because the amount of thinking and energy that I put into a piece is definitely connected to the experience of a listener listening to it, but it can't be the most important thing, and it can't be the most direct thing. And it's a very odd thing, you know, because some of the smartest people I know are really bad composers. And some of the best music, I think, in history is made by people who are just natural musicians, you know. So what we listen to in music, I think what we really feel is is a communication that we can't explain. You know, I think that that's the power of the musical contact between a performer and a listener, is that there's some kind of emotional current flowing from one to the other. And that's why when you go to a movie and the weepy music swells up, you know, the smart people cry and the stupid people cry, you know. I mean, it's not an intellectual experience.
We react.
Yeah, we react, right? And there's something about music which means that we don't have a protection against reacting. You know, the music gets into us whether we want it to or not. I think when at least for me, my experience as a listener is when I go into an audience, that's the way I hear music, is I hear the emotional connection. For me, all the intellectual things that I do, all the planning and all the thinking and the thoughtfulness is stuff that's on my side. You know, it's stuff that I need to do in order to figure out what kind of emotional connection I'm going to be able to make. But I think if there isn't an emotional connection, then why would anybody listen to it, you know?
You talked about your love of classical music. Do you think, and your work is so inventive and so incredible in its breadth, do you think of classic composers, of how their work would have been different if they were allowed in their time to be more inventive?
I would phrase that differently. You know, I think we love classical music so much and we worship it and revere it that sometimes we don't think of it as being revolutionary in its own time.
Right.
So all those things that I'm doing, pushing boundaries and asking, why can't I do this? Or, you know, I mean, there's...
They were doing that.
They, you know, Beethoven is much more revolutionary than me, you know. But we don't present Beethoven to our audiences as a revolutionary figure. We present him as part of the canon. And so we don't ever get to experience the idea that, what makes Beethoven's Fifth great is that there's a little idea at the beginning of the piece and it's still operating an hour later. That's a revolutionary idea.
But he didn't have people whispering. Well, probably because he was deaf. But he didn't have... Okay, there's that. but you still... But, you, yeah. You know, you have those aspects to it.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we maybe have allowed ourselves a broader palette of places to experiment.
Right.
But I do think that's something that's very, very interesting to me, that that people... forget that everything that we like about classical music was at its time experimental. And if you think about people working with weird instruments, you know, one of the things that we do at Bang on a Can all the time, and you mentioned the Ann Hamilton piece where we have an orchestra of people playing specially designed clothes made out of paper.
Right.
You know, Beethoven and Mozart wrote for the glass harmonica, which was the synthesizer of the day. And this was like a new technology that was invented, and it was a revolutionary idea that didn't last very long, you know. But they were very open to the idea that something new might come along that would spark their imagination, and they should do it.
You are a co-founder and co-artistic director of Bang on a Can, and a long partnership with Mass Mocha.
Right.
Why do you think it works? And why is it such a great creative place for you?
Well, it's interesting because when Michael Gordon and Julia Wolf and I started Bang on a Can, we were trying to think of who the ideal listeners were for this musical world we wanted to live in. And we thought that people in the art world are used to going to museums, going to galleries, seeing work which is challenging,
right,
which is not about... reminding you of how great the history was of where you come from. It's not about having a pleasant experience. Sometimes you go to the Whitney Biennial and you see work which is really, aggressive and maybe unpleasing, and people line up for blocks, to get in, and then they come out and they complain about it. But, you know, they're doing it every single day. You know, they're used to the idea that they're participating in the development of their culture as it happens in front of them. And we like that idea. And we think that that people who are used to seeing contemporary art may actually have a way into our world of contemporary music, which is different than if you come to it from classical music. So when we started talking to Joe Thompson at Mass MoCA about how we wanted to do a school, it seemed like a natural fit. You know, Mass MoCA has, since its very beginning, decided to make the making of work, right, the freshness of work, be part of the display of how the work happens. So it was very easy to tell them, you know, you're already doing this to see how people make things out of stone and make things out of metal. Why don't you do things this way for people who are making things out of sound and making things with instruments? It just seemed like a really natural partnership. And I have to say, we love it there and we love them. It's been a really great time.
So over the 8 days, what can people expect?
We have crammed the next 8 days full of every opportunity to do something interesting and strange in connection to the art, which is there this summer. So some of it, as you mentioned, is very natural to understand. The Ann Hamilton Paper Choir, which is on Thursday, or is it on Friday? I can't remember, but anyway. On the 29th.
Yep.
Some of it is also, you know, as you mentioned, Steve Reich's relationship to Solowit. They were very good friends, and so we're going to play Steve's music in there, and Steve is going to be there, which is a great honor for us, and Steve will talk about his friendship with Sol. There's also things which are more kind of metaphoric. We have Glenn Cochi, who's the drummer from Wilco.
Yes.
And for those of you who haven't been to Mass MoCA, there's this incredible sculpture in the entryway, which is a bunch of trees which have been planted so that they grow upside down.
Right.
And it's very beautiful. It's very natural. It's very organic. And there's something that's very wrong about
yeah.
it,
you know, weird,
and it's
yeah.
very disturbing and very strange, but also very beautiful because it's nature. It's nature trying to solve this problem. And so we thought that metaphorically that was related to Glenn Cochi, you know, because his life is as the drummer of Wilco. He's also an incredible composer. But the idea of taking the thing which is underneath and the support for something and moving that into the foreground and saying this is where the compositional action is, we thought that that was metaphorically like the tree project. But so every single gallery has something really exciting in it. And we have concerts during the day. We have concerts at night. We have all of this leading up to the 6-hour marathon on August 2nd, which is an incredible carnival of all sorts of things that our students and fellows and faculty have been working on for the last 3 weeks. So music by Steve Reich and Glenn Cochi, and music by this last year's Pulitzer Prize winner Carolyn Shaw, and a bunch of other interesting young composers. And it's a really incredibly fun event.
You can find out more information about all of this by going to massmocha.org or bangonacan.org/summerfestival, bangonacan.org or massmocha.org, or you can go to our website and we have a link there as well, wamc.org/roundtable. David Wang's Death Speaks will be performed at Mass MoCA this Saturday at 8 o'clock as part of the 13th annual Bang on a Can Summer Music Festival at Mass MoCA in North Adams, Massachusetts. The festival runs through August 3rd. Again, you can find out more information by going to massmocha.org or bangonacan.org. David Wang, what a great pleasure to have you come in and so beautifully explain what you do.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.